The following is a Reels Channel and Podcast One production, available on Apple Podcasts and PodcastOne.com.
This program contains graphic violence and sexual situations. Viewer discretion is advised.
In 1993, the world watches in terror as a skirmish between government forces and a potentially dangerous religious cult in Waco, Texas, begins with bloodshed.
They were a doomsday cult and they wanted confrontation.
Is followed by a tense 51-day standoff and ends in a horrific fiery blaze. The Branch Davidians are led by a self-proclaimed prophet who takes multiple wives, allegedly has sex with underage girls, and believes he alone knows the secrets of a divine plan for the end of the world.
He said full knowledge of the Bible was implanted in his brain.
I hear you, Lord.
Who was this twisted spiritual leader consumed with the apocalypse?
The holy war is imminent. And we must be ready to fight.
And how did a lost news truck, an armed raid, and the cult leader's refusal to surrender lead to the loss of scores of lives?
My husband, my oldest son, my daughter, my family was gone.
A day doesn't go by that I don't think at least for a minute about it and the friends I lost.
Meet David Koresh, just a charismatic preacher leading his people to the promised land.
He lived and died for what he was preaching.
Until murder made him famous.
Senior crime reporter Steve Helling.
For almost 2 months, the negotiations between the Branch Davidian cult and the FBI were broadcast on national TV every single day.
Author Dick Rivas.
The whole operation at Mount Carmel from the government side was a TV production. The grunts in the ATF called the February 28th raid showtime.
Hundreds of journalists went to Waco, Texas to report on every shred of information. In some ways, it was like a reality show.
A few short weeks after the siege ended, an NBC TV movie entitled In the Line of Duty, Ambush in Waco premiered. It featured actor Timothy Daly in the role of David Koresh.
It's amazing that more than two decades later, there's still a big question. Did the FBI fire the first shot and ignite the whole compound? Or did David Koresh tell his followers it was time to kill themselves?
David Koresh is born as Vernon Howell in 1959. His mother, Bonnie Sue, is just 14 years old.
She was, by her own admission, a prostitute.
The first man to take on any father role for young Vernon was an abusive alcoholic.
He is the boyfriend of Vernon's young mother.
What did I tell you about leaving your toys on the furnace?
For alleged disobedience, Vernon's feet are reportedly burned on a hot floor heater.
Ah! I'm sorry. Please.
Bonnie Sue leaves her abusive boyfriend, as well as her son, Vernon. His grandmother, Earlene Clark, steps in to raise him.
Vernon was one of those children who today we would recognize as dyslexic.
Due in part to a severe stutter, Vernon is bullied and humiliated by classmates. One of his few sources of solace is religion.
He memorized perhaps the whole Bible.
As the years pass, Vernon listens to preachers on the radio for hours on end, mimicking their speech in an attempt to overcome his stutter.
I read in the Old Testament scriptures about the suffering that the Messiah must endure.
Vernon's grandmother really encouraged his love for preaching and took him to a Seventh-day Adventist church. But the church that they went to wasn't all about love and grace, but it was about hellfire and brimstone and the return of Jesus Christ.
Vernon had been raised to believe that the end of the world was coming, all sorts of bloody and vengeful events. He became more profound about it, meaning he began to look for signs of it, to interpret passages.
At 18 years old, Vernon drops out of high school and finds work as a carpenter. But his real love is music.
He thought of music as a means of spreading the gospel.
While listening to sermons at church, the pastor's 15-year-old daughter soon catches the 22-year-old Vernon's eye.
The coming of Christ is at hand. Therefore, we must be always ready.
Despite the age difference, the two begin a relationship.
Vernon Howell was not only having sex with a minor, but he impregnated her.
Vernon seeks advice from the pastor and church elders, but their response is not what he's expecting.
Daddy, no!
Shut up! This thing you did to my daughter is an abomination. It's the devil's work! But it's a work that will never exist. And you get out of here and you never come back.
And when he made this known to the pastor pretty much ran him off.
Out of here, damn it!
Vernon Howell has been banished from the Seventh-day Adventist church he attends in Houston when he hears about a religious sect in Waco, Texas, called the Branch Davidians.
The Branch Davidians had similar beliefs to the Seventh-day Adventists, and they started a compound that they called Mount Carmel.
In 1982, Vernon moves to Waco, where the Branch Davidians have been going strong for over 50 years.
He shows up there probably for the same reasons that everyone else showed up there. There was some part of the Bible they didn't understand and wanted to figure out, or they had a faith, but they felt that it wasn't full enough.
Professor of History of Religions, Catherine Wessinger.
The Branch Davidians believe that anybody who is able to put together all these passages in a persuasive way to shed light on the imminent end time events, the last days, that person's inspired by God. They regard them as a prophet.
When Vernon Howell shows up at Mount Carmel, the church is under the leadership of 68-year-old Lois Roden.
Disciple on earth. It was she who anointed his head for burial and washed his feet with her tears of repentance.
She and he began to have the usual theological discussions that you get into in places like Mount Carmel. And so he had this prophetic view of the book of Revelation and of the Bible.
Lois sees Vernon as a prophet sent by God.
God has come back through you, Vernon. I can feel him all over you. I want to feel the Son of Man growing inside of me. I want the Lamb to dwell in me.
The affair is mutually advantageous, as they both allegedly see an opportunity to procreate in the name of God.
They believed that because a character named Sarah in the Old Testament had given birth at the age of 80, that she too could give birth again. So they tried to do that.
Branch Davidian leader Lois Roden stuns her congregation and her son George. At almost 70 years old, Lois claims to be pregnant with Vernon's child.
I have found favor with God, and with his help, the Lamb he sent me can do anything.
To this day, it is unknown if Lois Roden was really pregnant, but she allegedly suffers a miscarriage shortly thereafter.
Lois was 68 years old, and she said that she had miscarried Vernon's child. But she still viewed him as her spiritual son, so she turned the pulpit over to him. And that made her biological son very angry.
As a self-proclaimed prophet and the new leader of the Branch Davidians, Vernon still believes he must conceive children for God, so he turns his attention to 14-year-old Rachel, who can bear him a child.
The thing with prophets, they do a lot of things that are strange to the everyday person because God tells them. So if he says, well, God told me to take Rachel, you know, you don't kick up a big fuss.
Lois is presumably a woman scorned, but banishing Vernon, who has amassed a group of followers, will not be easy.
And those who love me are the lad.
George Roden, feeling he's the rightful heir to the Branch Davidian throne, casts Vernon and his flock out by force.
No!
My daddy built this.
I'll be damned if the likes of you are going to take it from me.
All right, George. All right. We're leaving, okay?
All right.
We're leaving.
George forced Vernon and his followers off the property at gunpoint.
But Vernon Howell won't go away quietly. He is convinced he's the only true prophet to lead the Branch Davidians, and he devises a violent scheme to regain power. In Texas, charismatic preacher Vernon Howell, who will soon call himself David Koresh, is no longer the leader of the Branch Davidians. He's been forced out of Mount Carmel at gunpoint. Now homeless, Vernon and over 20 followers set up camp in Palestine, Texas, 90 miles from Waco. Free from the clutches of Lois Roden, Vernon can wed his 14-year-old teenage lover, Rachel, whose parents are also two of Vernon's followers, and freely give their consent.
It's okay, Rachel. I'm not going to hurt you. God wants me to love you, to help you, to help me fulfill his prophecies.
In Texas, the legal age that a girl could get married was 14, with parental permission. So that was totally legal.
I mean, you want the Messiah to look favorably on you, don't you?
Yes.
Well, you are now my wife. God's going to use you.
Vernon allegedly consummates their marriage that night after his young bride falls asleep in a van. In 1985, young Rachel Jones delivers Vernon's first child, a son he names Cyrus.
Koresh had a son who would someday follow in his footsteps and rule God's kingdom. David Koresh believed that having children was the best way to grow this movement.
For 2 years, Vernon and his followers live in buses and tents without running water or electricity.
It was rough living conditions for them. They were basically camping in East Texas. And Vernon took this time to experiment with his message and also redefine what a prophet for the Branch Davidians would be.
One day during the mid-1980s, Vernon claims that God's message is made manifest to him.
David says that full knowledge of the Bible was implanted in his brain.
I hear you, Lord. I hear you.
Vernon believes that he will become a martyr, and the place of his martyrdom will be Mount Carmel. Back at the Branch Davidian compound, Lois Roden has died, and her son George has officially taken over. But George isn't of sound mind, and support for his leadership is declining.
Lois had a son, George Roden, who always presumed that with the passing of Lois, he would be the new prophet at Mount Carmel. There was a problem with this. Put simply, George wasn't sane.
George engineers a stunt to regain his status as the true prophet of Mount Carmel.
Father, I thank you that you have heard me.
Come forth!
He dug up the body of a woman who had been buried there 20 or 30 years earlier.
Vernon sees this as an opportunity for George to be locked up and pushed out of power if the authorities will intervene.
Branch Davidian, Clive Doyle.
Vernon heard about it and went to the sheriff's department and says, isn't it illegal to dig up a body? He said, yes.
The sheriff's department wants proof, however, so Vernon sets out to get photographic evidence. Knowing that George Roden is mentally unstable and armed to the teeth, Vernon brings along a few followers who are armed.
Among George's bad habits was carrying a machine gun. And Koresh and them, of course, knew that. And they go out to Mount Carmel.
He went back out there to try to look in the casket. Well, George comes out with a submachine gun or whatever and starts shooting.
Go, 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 go!
There are no major injuries, and Vernon and his followers are charged with attempted murder.
George George Roden was called to testify, apparently by the prosecution. And when George started to testify and the jurors realized that he was insane, they acquitted Vernon Howe.
George owed thousands of dollars in back taxes on the Mount Carmel property. So while he was away at a mental institution, Vernon actually got his followers together and they raised the money and moved right in.
With Lois Roden dead and George locked up, Vernon Howell becomes the official leader and prophet of the Branch Davidians. He changes his name to David Koresh.
David after King David in the Old Testament. Koresh being a version of the name for Cyrus, a Babylonian king who was kind to the Jews.
To David Koresh, this new name meant he was a Messiah, a descendant of David sent to earth to destroy the enemies of God.
In Texas, hundreds of people join Koresh for prayer sessions that sometimes lasts for hours and end with a rock song.
Branch Davidian, Sheila Martin.
Knowing the Bible was our biggest joy. Getting a study twice a day, and then in the evening, we'd stay up all night and we'd have our studies late in the night. David was teaching us about the things in the Bible, which came to many times, the end prophecies, which we believe we were getting closer and closer to.
David portrayed himself as an imperfect Messiah and said that the end times were coming soon.
The interpretation that David developed of the Bible was that in every generation, God sends a messenger to earth. That meant he was the guy who was going to preside at the end of the world.
God has told me to use this flesh, this holy flesh, for his glory.
David calls his doctrine the new light. In it, he states that sex is only for procreation.
It is detestable to God.
And introduces a controversial idea that all the women in the Branch Davidians are his spiritual wives.
And after the new light was announced, the only person they could sleep with was their husband, David Koresh.
You know what? Come on. I don't blame you for not believing. I can barely comprehend it myself. But God is not a man that he should lie. God commands it, it should be.
And my husband said, if I knew this was going to happen, I don't know if I would have come. We still saw each other each day. We ate with each other. But that moment when we would not be in the same bed or have children again together.
With every female at his disposal, Koresh can freely spread his seed and build what he calls the House of David.
Well, David believed he had to have 20-something children to act as judges on the rest of the world in the end times, and that these children had to be the sons of virgins. Pretty hard to find a virgin in Texas who's of adult age. So David perhaps had to select some underage victims. That led him into violating our statutory rape laws.
Although Koresh is married to Rachel, he ceremonially weds three more women, including Rachel's 12-year-old sister.
When David Koresh would choose a young lady to become his wife, he would reportedly give her a Star of David pendant.
He explained that God had told him to take certain women or whatever. Should they produce a child, that child was going to be special in the judgment.
At this point, there were about 100 Branch Davidians from all around the world. But some of them didn't agree with his practice of sleeping with young women.
Those who protest Koresh's practice of having sex with children revolt and leave Mount Carmel.
The Australian went to the embassy, told them children are being abused and little girls are getting raped.
How can a man rape his own wife? Wayne, they got a case here?
If everyone says the right thing, they don't.
Yeah, everybody will say the right thing. I'll make sure of that.
Soon, Koresh is reported to authorities.
Child Protective Services started investigating David Koresh for his unorthodox practices, and that put him on the government's radar for the very first time.
If found guilty of having sex with minors, David Koresh could be sent to prison for years. But if the master manipulator convinces authorities otherwise, David Koresh's end times may come sooner than he thinks.
Murder Made Me Famous. We'll be back after a word from our sponsors.
The truth is, most of us are brushing our teeth wrong, not for long enough, and forget to change our brush on time. That's because most brands focus on selling flashy gimmicks rather than better brushing. But not Quip. So, what makes Quip so different? For starters, Quip is an electric toothbrush that's a fraction of the cost of bulkier brushes, while still packaging just the right amount of vibrations to help clean your teeth. Quip's built-in timer helps you clean for the dentist's recommended 2 minutes with guiding pulses that remind you when to switch sides. Next, Quip's subscription plans are for your health, not just convenience. They send you new brush heads on a dentist-recommended 3-month schedule for just $5, including free shipping worldwide. Quip also comes with a mount that suctions right to your mirror that you can also use as a cover for hygienic travel wherever you take your teeth. And finally, everyone loves Quip. They were on Oprah's O-List, named one of Time's best inventions, and is the first subscription electric toothbrush accepted by the American Dental Association. Plus, they're backed by a network of over 20,000 dentists and hygienists, as well as hundreds of thousands of happy brushers who use Quip every day. Quip starts at just $25, and if you go to getquip.com/MMMF right now, you'll get your first refill pack free with a Quip electric toothbrush. That's your first refill pack free. Getquip.com/MMMF. That's GETQUIP.com/MMMF.
On this season of Cold Case Files, we'll close the book on the Golden State Killer, a serial killer so prolific, investigators spent years thinking he was three different people.
I think this offender is the most brazen in American history.
We'll find cryptic clues on business cards, diaries, and tombstones.
This defendant left his calling card at the scene of the crime.
Cold Case Files returns Tuesday, August 14th, wherever you listen to podcasts.
This program contains graphic violence and sexual situations. Viewer discretion is advised.
It's 1992, and David Koresh is the leader of the Branch Davidians, a Christian cult near Waco, Texas. Disapproval over Koresh's practice of forcing young girls into sex acts is beginning to circulate within Mount Carmel.
There was a small mutiny, and a handful of families reported David Koresh to Child Protective Services. And that caused other departments of the government to perk up and start taking notice.
A representative from Child Protective Services investigates the child abuse allegations. Koresh and his faithful are said to have prepared the children for the visit.
No, listen to me. You can't do this. But that's a lie. What's a lie to them is the truth to God. They have no faith. They don't understand God's ways. Remember that God will repay each person according to what they've done. You want God to look on you favorably, don't you?
The children were brought to Child Protective Services where they were interviewed, and she could not find any evidence of child abuse. So she had to close the case for lack of evidence.
David Koresh may have escaped the child abuse charges, but there were other problems on the horizon. He was stockpiling assault weapons, not only to sell them, but also for his own defense.
Retired Special Agent Chuck Hustmeyer.
Witnesses told ATF agents that they frequently heard automatic gunfire coming from the area of the compound.
So he went into it as a way to earn money to support his community. There were approximately 125 people out there that they needed to support.
They believed that if they were attacked by a non-Christian power, they should defend their faith.
The Branch Davidians weren't a peaceful religion, sitting out there on Sunday having worship services. They were armed with semi-automatic and fully automatic rifles. So the idea of them being a peaceful religion is just a joke. I mean, there's nothing peaceful about them.
There's a scripture in the Bible that talks about God's people fighting. You know, David said that the time for turning the other cheek is gone. So you have the right to defend yourself.
To David Koresh, surrender is not an option for him or his followers.
Jacob!
You get over here now, boy. What are you doing?
Oh, I was just playing around.
Get up. You do not play with guns. Do you understand me, you animal?
Yes, sir.
You are not holding a gun unless you are preparing for the end. And where's this going in the end? Come on, son.
That's good, son.
These semi-automatic weapons really only have one purpose, and it's to shoot people. So I think that David Koresh had his congregation convinced that the government was going to come for them, and they were amassing a stockpile of weapons to use against the government, which, of course, is exactly what happened.
One afternoon, an unwitting delivery driver makes an unexpected discovery.
All right. Jacob! Jacob, come here. Hey, pick that up.
The ATF had received tips about military-grade weapons and ammo coming into the compound.
The case agents are wondering, well, what are they preparing for? What is it that they need all this stuff for?
In 1992, the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, or ATF, begins investigating the Mount Carmel compound with round-the-clock monitoring.
They rented a house that sat at the end of that driveway, just across the street. And they put six or eight ATF agents in there who told the Davidians that they were college students.
ATF agent Robert Rodriguez approaches the Branch Davidians, posing as a new member, in an attempt to get to know Koresh better.
Some people say that David knew that they were under surveillance and that there was an undercover agent in their midst. And with all the activity going on outside, you've got to think that he knew that something was wrong.
But the ATF allegedly doesn't realize that David is suspicious of the new recruit. They prepare to raid Mount Carmel, practicing tactical maneuvers at nearby Fort Hood.
David Koresh preached this doomsday apocalyptic sermon all the time, and he told everybody in his congregation that the government was going to come for them. And, you know, in my opinion, I think he created the scenario in which that would happen.
This persecution that David had talked about and preached about was now coming to his doorstep. Koresh even gave a nickname to the Mount Carmel compound. He called it Ranch Apocalypse.
The ATF have a myriad of reasons to get inside Mount Carmel. Authorities fear that Koresh will lead his congregation to start a holy war if they don't intervene quickly.
You know, we had been briefed on approximately how many guns David Koresh had. We knew that it could be very violent, so the element of surprise was crucial to us.
The ATF is ready to raid the compound. But on February 27th, 1993, just one day before the raid, the Waco Tribune Herald introduces David Koresh to the world.
It published the first of a series called The Sinful Messiah.
Sort of the theme is, well, here's a guy out there doing all this illegal stuff, and no one seems to be doing anything about it.
On Saturday afternoon, David said, go outside and play football or something. Run around, just show that we're just a normal church.
We were thinking that they would become nervous that the government was actually preparing to do something. To us, it was a kind of a bad omen.
The ATF's plan is to raid the compound after church. Once the men have left the building and the women and children are alone inside, ATF agents will arrest David Koresh and anyone who resists.
But there were two main problems on the morning of the raid. First of all, the weather was bad, so all the men had to stay inside with the women and children in the compound.
The second problem was that the news media got wind of the raid. To this day, it is not certain who tipped them off.
And at least one of those TV crews got lost on the way and had to ask a postman for directions.
However, the news crew has no idea that the postman is a Branch Davidian, who immediately tips off David Koresh.
You know, he specifically said ATF and the National Guard are coming, and that's exactly who was coming.
We felt the devil was very angry with what was happening. We were reading and studying and changing our lives every day. So as a result, we were being a target of the devil.
Koresh prepares his congregation for a showdown. But first, he has to excise the traitor in their midst.
I've never felt it more strongly. Armageddon is near. The Holy War is imminent, and we must be ready to fight. Are you ready to fight?
Yes!
I said, are you ready to fight?
Yes!
One of you must betray me. Has already betrayed me. Ready yourselves for war. They are coming. The time has come. Ready yourselves, I said.
Due to the activity across the road, Koresh already suspects that undercover ATF agent Robert Rodriguez is, in his eyes, a wolf in sheep's clothing.
The agent rushed in his car back across the street to the undercover house and told the people there, we have to call off the raid. They know we're coming.
ATF management decides not only to proceed, but to move up the raid.
So instead of backing off, the ATF management decided to press forward and sort of double down on this. This was the biggest operation in ATF history. No one wanted to be responsible for putting the brakes on this thing.
As the ATF readies to search the compound, David Koresh readies for a holy war. When the two groups meet face to face, it will be one of the most tragic collisions in U.S. law enforcement history. February 28, 1993. ATF agents approach the Branch Davidian compound in Waco, Texas, intending to execute a search warrant on cult leader David Koresh. They are braced for conflict.
Driving up there to that compound that day was eerie. It was quiet. It was like a ghost town. I turned to an agent next to me and I said, you know, this doesn't look good. I mean, you could just feel that this was going to go bad quick.
Just keep the kids calm, okay? Stay calm. Is that it? Okay.
The key to a dynamic raid is to get in fast before they have a chance to defend themselves. So the element of surprise in this operation was the key. And we lost that. And we knew we lost that.
David Koresh's day of reckoning has arrived.
Hey, go away, all right? There's women and children here.
That's when all hell broke loose.
We don't know if the first shots were fired from helicopters in the air by ATF agents or if the first shots were fired from inside Mount Carmel at the ATF agents. All of these facts are disputed.
They come shooting through the door and everything, shot David. People inside knew that David had been wounded. It might have galvanized them more into participating.
My first thought was to put my two children, the six-year-old and four-year-old, on the floor. And then as I looked over, I wanted to get my son, my handicapped child, my crawler, my hands and knees. My little six-year-old said, why the bad man here?
My initial assignment was to go around the back and secure the rear of the compound. I didn't make it that far. Agent in front of me was shot. There were a couple Branch Davidians with rifles shooting at us on the left side of the compound, and I was able to take cover behind a bulldozer and return fire.
People on both sides of the conflict attempt to end the gunfight, but each ceasefire is met with resumed violence.
Hello.
Yeah, this is Lieutenant Lynch. May I help you?
Yeah, there's 75 men around our building, and they're shooting at us in Mount Carmel.
Mount Carmel?
Yeah, tell them there's children and women in here and to call it off.
Once we were there and pinned down, well, we were wondering how we're going to get out, and one of the agents near me said, well, I hope the local police are coming. And I looked at him and I said, there's no one coming. I mean, we're it.
After a 2.5 hour gunfight between the Branch Davidians and the ATF, 10 people are dead and 32 are injured.
We had two agents dead on the roof. You have two other agents dead around the front of the compound and just a dozen or so wounded who some could walk, some couldn't walk.
The ATF had not drawn up a backup plan. They used a couple of civilian pickups. They carried each other. The footage of that retreat will break your heart.
I was helping to carry a dead agent, and we were trying to put him in the back of the ambulance, but the ambulance was packed with wounded agents. So we ended up having to take a dead ATF agent and put him in the front seat right next to the driver.
Inside the compound, Koresh is severely wounded but refuses treatment.
My feeling was that this is not over. They're going to come back tonight or sometime to get vengeance.
That night, it began moving tanks and armored vehicles into the area, set up sniper positions, keeping the Davidians in the crosshairs.
The ATF and Branch Davidians are now in a stalemate. Media coverage continues, and the nation watches the standoff in real time.
There were probably 200 reporters there.
The FBI is eventually brought in to attempt negotiations.
ATF was sort of relegated to the outer perimeter at that point. And then the FBI began their, 51-day psyops deal to try to get Davidians to surrender.
The first thing they did was cut off David Koresh's telephone access.
The FBI installs a direct line so that only they can speak to Koresh and negotiate for the release of everyone in the compound.
There was always this fear that the Branch Davidians were going to commit mass suicide. They were going to pull like a Jonestown, Guyana, drink the Kool-Aid thing. And David Koresh had been training the adults and even the kids to commit suicide.
He had constructed this theology that he was going to die, his family and friends were going to die. You know, the Branch Davidians wanted to live. They were afraid, but they were faithful to David Koresh's interpretations.
As long as we're surrounded, we're not coming out. Did you not hear what I just said? We're not coming out.
The standoff becomes a regular story on the nightly news as the FBI works to negotiate with Koresh.
They set up two different teams. One team was going to negotiate with David Koresh, and the other team was going to rescue as many hostages as they could.
The FBI convinces Koresh to release a handful of members, including Sheila Martin and some children who are not his own.
And as I told my husband goodbye, he kissed me on the cheek. He said, I will stay in. Everyone's going to be out. I want them out first, and then the rest of us will go out. No way, in any way, did we believe that there was going to be anything negative. The people outside kept telling us, we'll take care of you, bring your Bible.
Hostage situations are typically resolved in 6 to 8 hours. But the FBI negotiations with David Koresh last an unprecedented 51 days.
Basically, what the FBI did is it waged psychological warfare against the Branch Davidians.
First of all, they put up speakers and playing such things as the sound of rabbits being killed, telephones off the hook.
They were subjected to sleep deprivation, food deprivation, water deprivation.
It was trying to make life unbearable inside.
Mama, we didn't die. We may leave this body behind, but we'll never die.
David Koresh told the negotiators that their tactic of blasting loud music and noise into the compound was actually backfiring on them.
And what it was doing, it was proving David Koresh's prophecies that they were going to be opposed and ultimately assaulted again and killed by the agents, the satanic agents that are described in the book of Revelation.
Meanwhile, the press is assembled down the road, impatiently waiting for a big showdown.
So the FBI and the world saw that the women and children, and for that matter, the males at Mount Carmel, were endangered and should come out, should surrender. But the people in Mount Carmel felt they were in something like Noah's Ark. When you're in Noah's Ark, you don't jump out.
Despite the fact that Branch Davidians have killed 4 ATF agents, they do gain supporters. Protesters gather down the road to stand against what they see as the government encroaching upon the land and gun rights of private citizens. Standing in the crowd is a young man named Timothy McVeigh, who himself will become infamous just 2 years later. Finally, Koresh offers to release everyone at Mount Carmel, but only if he can first write his religious credo, the Seven Seals.
So the FBI said, this is just another stunt by David Koresh to buy time. And it decided to go in and put an end to things.
But the decision to go in and take action had devastating consequences.
The epic standoff between law enforcement and the Branch Davidians has reached its tipping point. Will the FBI be able to rescue the innocent lives at stake? Or will they go down in Koresh's holy war? 1993. The skirmish between law enforcement and the Branch Davidian cult results in numerous casualties, including four ATF agents. After a 51-day standoff, the government has had enough.
As long as we're surrounded, we're not coming out.
Concerned about deteriorating conditions and agent fatigue, the FBI suggests the use of tear gas. Newly appointed U.S. Attorney General Janet Reno approves the plan.
Day 51 started with an announcement they were going to start spraying gas in. So I put a gas mask on. We know there was none for the kids. They don't make them that small, you know. And sure enough, they start, you know, breaching the walls.
I think law enforcement was counting on the Branch Davidians' natural parental instincts to release their children.
The Branch Davidians allegedly feel such a strong allegiance to Koresh, they refuse to leave, and the adults quickly fight back.
They were firing at the armored vehicles. FBI, unlike ATF, had a lot more than canvas tarps covering them. They were in military-style armored vehicles. Bullets were just dinging off of them.
The FBI continues to penetrate the compound and pour in tear gas.
Take the children to the chambers.
I don't fault the FBI for being too aggressive. I mean, you just can't put up with this forever.
Unfortunately, the Branch Davidians made a choice not to release their children. They could have done it at any time, but they just didn't.
They put the children and their mothers accompanied them inside a concrete room.
They wanted to keep their children in Mount Carmel where God was in control. And if their children had to die, or if the mothers had to die, that was God's undertaking, so they were not afraid of death.
Several of us were in the chapel when somebody yelled out, "The building's on fire."
We don't know if the fire started because the Davidians lit it on fire in a deliberate attempt to burn down the building, or whether it may have been accidentally started.
What are we supposed to do now? Pray.
All of a sudden, this smoke comes down the outside wall. And everything just turned black. Almost immediately after that, you could feel heat in the ceiling, oppressive heat. At one point, I heard some of the guys behind me screaming, and I knew they were getting burned. And I think that somehow galvanized me to get up and try to get out.
So what happened to David Koresh? Well, the only unequivocal truth that we have is the forensics.
David, get over here and help me with this fuel, man.
I'm on the last seal.
They're killing us.
I'm on the last seal.
What the hell are you doing? You really think they're just going to let you walk out of here?
An FBI spokesperson later suggests that aide Stephen Schneider is dismayed when Koresh doesn't take his own life as he's preached. Feeling that Koresh is a fraud, he allegedly takes matters into his own hands.
David and Stephen Schneider's bodies were found together on the first floor, near each other.
80 people remain inside, 25 of them children.
The majority of the women and children were in a cold storage locker that was built of cement, whose roof was collapsed by a boom from an FBI tank cement fell on them. Some of them died from gunshot wounds, apparently from their mothers or fathers, and most of them died of smoke inhalation.
There are 9 people who escaped the fire, including Clive Doyle.
I lost my youngest daughter. She was 18. I didn't know where she was. You know, I've been kicking myself ever since that I didn't get up there and save her wherever she was.
15 minutes after the fire begins, Fire trucks arrive, but are held at a checkpoint 4 miles away. Camera crews from around the world broadcast the inferno. The government indicts a number of surviving Branch Davidians for aiding and abetting in the murder of federal officers and for firearms charges. 7 are found guilty and receive varying sentences. Despite allegations of cover-ups, the government's official report concludes that David Koresh was solely to blame. Law enforcement is heavily criticized for its handling of the crisis.
This is a profound disgrace to law enforcement in the United States of America.
Law enforcement learned a lot from our mistakes. The idea of huge, dynamic entry raids on a fortified compound, you know, that died with Waco.
In 1995, pro-Branch Davidian protester Timothy McVeigh carries out the bombing of the Oklahoma City Federal Building with Terry Nichols. It is exactly 2 years to the day of the Mount Carmel inferno. DNA evidence later reveals that David Koresh sired at least 12 of the children who died in the inferno. David Koresh was 33 years old.
Despite the fact that dozens of people died and hundreds of more people were affected by David Koresh, there are still people to this day who believe in him.
David came to give us a message and a hope, and we hope to see him again. Our regret is only that we didn't serve God better.
Clive Doyle still lives in Waco and still has Bible study every Saturday with Sheila Martin. Now, more than 2 decades after the apocalypse in Waco, a group of believers have resurrected their church and call themselves the Branch, the Lord our righteousness. They continue to wait for the end times.
That concludes this episode of Murder Made Me Famous. Don't forget to go to Reels.com, that's R-E-E-L-Z.com, for clips, extras, and more. And check out new episodes every Saturday on the Reels channel. Don't forget to subscribe on PodcastOne.com, the Podcast One app, and Apple Podcasts.
Hey guys, it's Jack Vanek from The Lady Gang, and I am sitting here with true crime TV producer and my best friend, Alexis Linkletter, and we are so excited that we are finally launching our true crime podcast called The First Degree right here on Podcast One.
And each week, we are going to bring you the craziest true crime stories and talk to the people who are 1 degree away from each of these crazy events.
And we've dragged crime journalist Billy Jensen along for the ride, and he can't get rid of us.
Join us on The First Degree every Wednesday on PodcastOne.com and the PC One app.
Also remember to rate and review.